Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good evening, everybody. Okay, we have been studying Sutta number 66 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Latuki Kokkama Sutta. That is the discourse on the simile of the quail. And the theme of this discourse is renunciation and the need to follow the Buddha's instructions in abandoning what the Buddha tells us to abandon. And as we saw, the Buddha is in conversation with a monk named Udayi, and he speaks about how some of the disciples, when the Buddha tells them to abandon something, they think this is trivial, unimportant, and they don't give it up, they don't abandon it. And as a result, that practice that they don't abandon becomes an obstacle to their development. Whereas those who follow the Buddha's instruction and give up what the Buddha advises them to abandon are able to make progress and to advance in their spiritual life. And so here the Buddha has been speaking about the way to the abandoning of what is called, I'm in, on page 556. Paragraph 16, actually it starts above paragraph 14. The theme here is the way to the abandoning of the acquisitions. And the word or the expression in Pali is upaddi pahana or upaddi patinisaggo. And this word upaddi, it's one of the really very important words in the Buddha's teaching. As I explained last week, it comes from the root da, which means to put or to place, and then the prefix upa, which means close, nearby. So these are the things that one puts close to oneself, the things that one takes possession of. Okay, and then the Buddha's teaching speaks about, or the Buddha's texts, they speak about four kinds of upaddi, four kinds of acquisitions. One kind of acquisition are simply objects of enjoyment, what we ordinarily call possessions. These would include material possessions as well as I'm sorry, against the background of the Indian society at that time, a man has his wife and children, so they are considered like personal possessions. But also women will think their husband and their children are personal possessions as well. Okay, so these are upaddhi acquisitions in the sense of material possessions, including personal relationships. Then going to a deeper level, there is the inner defilements, greed, hatred, and delusion. These are things normally we don't think we're clinging to them, but they're the very deep-rooted tendencies of the mind that we bring along with us as we go through our whole life. And then as we move through the cycle of birth and death, these are the foundations on which our lives are based. Okay, so this is the second type of acquisition, the defilements of the mind. And then the third type of acquisition are our karmic activities. That is, we engage in wholesome, unwholesome activities. These activities create karma, good and bad karma, and this is what we take along with us. This is our inner possession. And our karma, the karmic activities we engage in, these are the things that create our future, build up our destiny. They build up our character, they build up our destiny. And so whatever we are is in a sense the product of our actions. And so our personality, our character, with all of its tendencies and dispositions, are built up through repeated actions, habitual actions. And so these habitual actions become our possessions or acquisitions. And then the fourth level of the acquisitions is maybe the deepest level, and that is the five aggregates, the five constituents of our individual identity. So these five aggregates are bodily form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. So these are the things that at the subtlest level we cling to as being I and mine. And because of this clinging to these five aggregates, when we come to one death, then that clinging, we have to give up this body with all of its experience, but that clinging will then move on and build up another set of five aggregates, builds up a new identity, which then becomes our set of acquisitions, our possessions. And so through the defilements, craving, greed, hatred, and delusion, craving and ignorance, we engage in karmic activities. The karmic activities build up a new set of the five aggregates. And then our craving latches on to possessions in the outer world, whether material things or people, holds to them and clings to them, and in that way maintains our attachments. So this is the pattern that binds together all of these upaddhi, these acquisitions. We can say, maybe to put it in a schematic way, Okay, so these are the four types of upaddhi acquisitions. And the Buddha's teaching aims at upaddhi pahana, the abandoning of the acquisitions, or subupaddhi patinisago, that is the relinquishing, the giving up of all the acquisitions. Okay, so last time I went through these four types of persons that the Buddha speaks of who are practicing the way to the abandoning of the acquisitions. The first of these is the person who, when memories and thoughts connected with the acquisitions arise in him, he tolerates them, he doesn't abandon them, and this person remains in fetters, in bondage. The second person is the one when the memories and thoughts about the acquisitions arise, he doesn't tolerate them, but he makes the effort to abandon them, to get rid of them. This person too is still fettered, but he's practicing to eliminate the fetters, to get free from bondage. The third person is one who has made some progress in abandoning the fetters, in abandoning the acquisitions, but still from time to time, when his mindfulness is a little bit slack, then memories and thoughts about the acquisitions arise in him. But when they arise, then he immediately recognizes this and then makes the effort to abandon them. Then the fourth person the Buddha speaks of is one who, this is in paragraph 17, it's the one who has understood that acquisition is the root of suffering. And so he completely abandons the acquisitions and he is liberated through the destruction of the acquisitions. That means basically the destruction of the defilements. And so the Buddha says, this person I call unfettered, free from the fetters, free from bondage. Okay, so that was the point where we left off last time. And now we'll come into the new material. Now the Buddha is going to go through in sequence the things that he advises his disciples to abandon or to overcome. And he begins at the coarsest level with what are called the five cords of sensual pleasure or the five objects of sensual pleasure. So what are these five objects of sensual pleasure? Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, likable, connected with sensual desire, and provocative of lust or craving. Similarly, sounds, odors, flavors, and tangibles or tactile objects. So those are the five cords of sensual pleasure, or five objects of sensual pleasure. Okay, then the Buddha says, the pleasure and joy that arise dependent on these five objects of sensual pleasure, that is what is called sensual pleasure. That is the sensual pleasure itself. It's the feeling of pleasure, the feeling of joy that arises when one is able to acquire objects of sensual pleasure and to indulge that desire. the objects of sensual pleasure, that belongs to the fourth type of upaddhi, possessions that give rise to sensual pleasure. And the craving for that sensual pleasure, the craving that motivates one to indulge in it, that belongs to the defilements. Okay, now the Buddha goes on to make a statement that seems to us maybe somewhat strong. Okay, he says, the sensual pleasure, this is a filthy pleasure, a coarse pleasure, an ignoble pleasure. I say of this kind of pleasure that it should not be pursued, should not be developed, should not be cultivated, that it should be feared. Okay, I think first we have to understand it seems like such a strong statement, but we have to understand the context in which the Buddha is making this statement. When the Buddha is speaking to householders, he doesn't tell them, give up sensual pleasures, renounce the world, give up your relations with your wife, your husband. He doesn't try to interfere in their relations at all. He tells people, lay people, to live in accordance with the third precept, which is to avoid misconduct, illicit conduct, in regard to sensual pleasures. That is, to avoid any kind of sexual relations which go against the principles of morality. Adultery, seduction, exploitation of people for one's sexual enjoyment. But in this discourse, we have to remember that the Buddha is speaking to a monk, and this discourse is intended for monastic persons. And so that is why the Buddha is using such strong language in order to discourage his monastic disciples from the temptation to indulge in sensual enjoyment. Okay, now maybe the question comes up, why does the Buddha take this critical attitude to sensual pleasure? We might think sensual pleasure is something enjoyable, harmless, it gives us some degree of happiness. And that is actually the case within the world. But the Buddha's teaching is pointing to a higher type of happiness, a higher type of pleasure. It's not that the Buddha wants to kill, to be a killjoy, discouraging us from any kind of enjoyment, but there are different levels of pleasure, different levels of happiness. And the pleasure, the enjoyment that comes from the senses, according to the Buddha's teaching, is the lowest type of pleasure. Okay, for most people living in the world, usually we meet with a lot of pain, a lot of trouble. We have to work many hours a day. Then we get sometimes feelings of discouragement, boredom, restlessness. And so in that situation, the normal way of escaping from the days of toiling at work, periods of boredom, blandness, is through engaging in the enjoyment of sense pleasures. This gives some kind of excitement to life, some kind of, what do they call this? The spice of life. And so we see so much attention is lavished on various commodities. We have always changing fashions every season. People like to dress in bright, cheerful colors, provocative colors. If you go down to Broadway, 42nd Street in Manhattan, you see all of the movie theaters have flashing lights. Why do they have the flashing lights? To try to attract you. Okay, so the Buddha's teaching begins by investigating the different types of sensual pleasures, but then the Buddha points out what he calls the drawback in sensual pleasures. The Pali word here is adinava. Okay, that is the danger or drawback in sensual pleasures. Now, when the Buddha gives a discourse on the Dhamma to people who are relatively new to the teaching, he doesn't begin at once by emphasizing the drawback in sense pleasures. Usually, he begins by praising qualities like generosity or giving. Then he'll speak about the benefits in practicing morality, avoiding harm to others, being honest, being faithful in one's personal relationships, speaking the truth, avoiding harsh speech, and so on. Then the next step that the Buddha teaches is law of karma, how our actions have consequences, how bad actions, unwholesome actions, immoral actions lead to unfortunate states of rebirth, and how good actions, wholesome actions, lead to higher states of rebirth, in which one can experience great happiness, great power, great bliss. But then, when the Buddha sees that the people who are listening are responsive, that their minds are opening up, then and only then does he introduce this theme about the drawbacks or dangers in sensual pleasures. And then when the Buddha meets with those who are disposed to enter the monastic life, then he lays down this rule of celibacy as one of the conditions for entering the monastic life. So the third precept that a lay person takes is the precept to abstain from misconduct in regard to sensual pleasures, to abstain from any kind of illicit behavior regarding sensual pleasures. But the precept that a monastic person takes is the precept of what is called brahmacharya, which means the precept of celibacy. Yeah, we translate brahmacharya as celibacy, but the word really has a much deeper meaning. First, it's made up of two parts, brahma and charya. The word brahma was the word used in ancient India to designate the sacred reality, the holy reality, the divine reality. And charya means conduct. And so brahmacharya is conduct, behavior that leads to realizing the divine reality. And so the Buddha took this word over, this expression, to signify the type of behavior that leads to the realization of what we call the divine reality in his own teaching, which is Nibbana, Nirvana. And so the Buddha's teaching, it's intended to lead to the achievement of a superior reality, a state which is, we call this the unconditioned, a state free from birth, aging, sickness, and death. And that is Nirvana. And then the whole practice of the Buddha's teaching, in its most general way, is called brahmacharya, in that it is the path to Nirvana, to Nibbana. But sometimes the word brahmacharya is used in a narrower sense to mean the practice of celibacy. And this was part of the common Indian yogic tradition. It's also prescribed in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. It's made a requirement by the teachers of Vedanta, the path of Vedanta. So just about all of the mainstream Indian yogic and contemplative systems observe brahmacharya as celibacy. And the root idea here is that by restraining the expression of sexual desire, one builds up an inner force, an inner strength, which enables one to open up new dimensions of the mind, new dimensions of consciousness, which are ordinarily covered over by our attachment to sensual pleasures and material possessions. I sometimes think of the mind or consciousness as being structured in certain strata, certain layers. So we have these different strata of the mind, different layers, which in one way we could see that they're always existing within us. The most superficial level is what I call the sensory consciousness. This is a consciousness which is involved with the sensory world, the world of form, sounds, odors, tastes, tactile objects, as well as the ideas, images, thoughts that are all usually just floating through the mind. Okay, then as And usually most people live their whole life completely in this realm of the sensory consciousness. So they have almost no access to the other realms of consciousness. Their whole life is spent, the waking life, involved, engaging in sensory experiences. And their only turn off from the sensory experience is going to sleep. So it's a life which alternates between sleep and sensory involvements. Okay, even Buddha and Arahants still have the sensory consciousness. This isn't necessarily a consciousness gripped by sensual desire, but it's the consciousness dealing with the sensory world. But what keeps most people locked into this sensory consciousness is the sensual desire. We can say sensory desire and hatred, anger, ill will. Those are the two sides of the worldly mind. Craving for what's enjoyable, hatred and dislike for what is thought to be repulsive, disagreeable. Okay, but now there are other realms of consciousness potentially available to us. And so what happens when one starts to practice meditation is that one begins to stop reacting in the grip of sensual craving and ill will. Instead, one starts to collect the mind. We take an object, some single object, and we focus the mind on that object, even though distracting thoughts will arise, but we don't surrender to them, we don't flow along with them, but we just let them arise and pass away. And so we start collecting the mind by casting off sensual desire and ill will and hatred. And so this is bringing us to a deeper level where the mind is becoming collected, more peaceful, more settled. As the mind becomes increasingly collected, focused, absorbed in its object, then it passes completely beyond the sensory level and comes to a new level, which is the level of the jhanas. And so the first jhanic stages are what we can call the mind of joy and bliss. This is a much more refined, sublime type of pleasure than anything one can experience through the senses. Okay, then as the concentration deepens still more, then that joy falls away, and one enters into a state of greater tranquility. We call this the level of tranquil bliss. And then even that bliss becomes felt and experienced as something of a disturbance. And so as one goes still deeper, one comes to the level of what we call, or I'm calling, tranquil equanimity. Okay, so these are realms of consciousness always potentially available to us, but normally we don't gain access to them because of the bond of sensual desire. which is maintained by the attraction of sensual pleasure. And so the Buddha's teaching on the drawbacks in sensual pleasure is intended to lead us away from this fascination with sense pleasures in order that we can collect the mind, cast off the involvement with sensuality, and then we can deepen the consciousness to bring the mind to ever deeper levels of consciousness till we come to this level of tranquil equanimity, which is not yet nibbana. These are still stages of samadhi or concentration. But these are the stages that can be used most effectively to develop wisdom or insight, which brings liberation. Okay, so now we can go back to the text, and we see now that why the Buddha is saying of the sensual pleasure, for the monastics, he's saying, this kind of pleasure should not be pursued, should not be developed, should not be cultivated, it should be feared. Now the Buddha comes to the description of the jhanas. He says, here, Udayi, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk, a bhikkhu, enters and abides in the first jhana. Wanted to go to a section where we have a description. If you go to sutta number 27, I think we have the description of jhanas here. Yeah, on page 275, paragraph 19. He enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. This rapture and pleasure, that's what I mean by the same thing as this mind of joy and bliss. Then, going to paragraph 20, with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, he enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind without applied and sustained thought, but still with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. So this is still a mind of joy and bliss. But then next, he moves into the third jhana, paragraph 21, with the fading away as well of rapture. That is, the joy fades away. The monk abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body. He enters upon and abides in the third jhana. Okay, so this is a state of what I call tranquil bliss, because the joy, which is a somewhat exciting quality, has faded away. But even this pleasure or bliss is something of a slightly disturbing state. So we go next to the fourth jhana, paragraph 22, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and has purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. This is what I call the state of tranquil equanimity. Okay, now we go back to the simile of the quail on page 557. the Buddha says of this type of pleasure, that of the four jhanas, he says, this is called the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. Actually, literally, the jhanas, the happiness of the jhanas, is not actually a state of enlightenment, but it's a state that is conducive to enlightenment. So this is why the Buddha calls it the bliss of enlightenment. And the Buddha says, I say of this kind of pleasure that it should be pursued, that it should be developed, it should be cultivated, it should not be feared. Okay, now the Buddha goes back to the first jhana, and he's going to show the defects even in the lower jhanas. He says, here, Udayi, quite secluded from sense pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a bhikkhu enters and abides in the first jhana. Now this, I say, belongs to the perturbable. There's a word that's used here. Injita. It means that there is some degree of disturbance in these states. Okay, and what is the disturbance in that state? The Buddha raises the question, what there belongs to the perturbable? What is it that causes some degree of disturbance? The applied thought and sustained thought that have not yet stopped there. That is what belongs to the perturbable. So even in this first jhana, there's some degree of thought or mental application. And that is, even though the mind is one-pointed, completely focused on the object, but that activity of mind that fixes the mind on the object, that is, creates a little bit of a disturbance. And so one has to give up that applied and sustained thought in order to enter into the second jhana, paragraph 23. But the Buddha says this too belongs to the perturbable. And what there belongs to the perturbable, what is causing the disturbance there? The rapture and pleasure that is still present there, or the joy and bliss that is still present there, that belongs to the perturbable. Okay, so the Buddha urges his monks to go further. He says, with the fading away as well of rapture, one practices more concentration, more samadhi, and at some point this joy or rapture fades away and one enters the third jhana. But the Buddha says, that too belongs to the perturbable. And what there belongs to the perturbable? I think the translation here, not so good. It says, the equanimity and pleasure that have not ceased there, that is what belongs to the perturbable. But now looking at it, I see what would be a better translation would be the pleasure of equanimity that has not ceased there. That is what belongs to the perturbable. It's not the equanimity itself that makes this a disturbance, but it's the fact that this pleasure is, that there's a pleasure connected with the equanimity. And so in the next stage, one abandons this feeling of pleasure to enter into the fourth jhana, in which the feeling is neither pleasant nor painful. It's a very, very peaceful, tranquil feeling. And so when one enters the fourth jhana, the Buddha says, this belongs to the imperturbable. This is the state that's free from disturbance. Okay, then the Buddha comes back to the beginning. Paragraph 26. Again, he speaks about the monk who enters and dwells in the first jhana. But now the Buddha says, this, I say, is analanti vadami. He says, this, I say, is not enough. It's not sufficient. It's not adequate. Abandon it, I say. Surmount it. Overcome it. Go beyond it. And what is beyond it? Here one enters and dwells in the second jhana. But now the Buddha says of the second jhana, that is not enough. Abandon it. Go beyond it. What is beyond the second jhana? The third jhana. But the Buddha says, this too, I say, is not enough. Abandon it, go beyond it. And what is beyond it? Here one enters and dwells in the fourth jhana. Normally, the Buddha will explain how one goes to the fourth jhana, and one could use the fourth jhana as a basis for reaching the destruction of all the defilements, for reaching full liberation. But for some reason, in this sutta, the Buddha wants to show even the subtler states that lie beyond the fourth jhana. These were stages of meditation which were known by the Indian yogis of the Buddha's time. And so the Buddha is mentioning them. Okay, now in the fourth jhana, even though it's called the imperturbable, but the mind still has some kind of form as its object. It could be some bright colored disc or some very subtle mental image. But now to go beyond the fourth jhana, one enters upon the formless meditations. In the formless meditations, first stage, one drops any kind of visible object, even that very subtle light seen with the mental eye, and instead one focuses upon the boundless nature of space. And so in paragraph 30, the Buddha says, here, with the complete surmounting or complete overcoming of perceptions of form, with the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite, the monk enters and dwells in the base of infinite space. So this is the first formless meditation, the base of infinite space. But the Buddha says, even of this, he says, abandon it, go beyond it. And what is beyond the base of infinite space? Okay, one completely overcomes the base of infinite space, aware that consciousness is infinite. Okay, one is focusing on space as infinite. But because one can be aware of infinite space, this means that one can experience the consciousness itself as infinite. And so one drops the attention to space and instead focuses on the consciousness that is aware of space. And so the monk then enters and dwells in the base of infinite consciousness. And now the Buddha says, this too, I say, is not enough. Abandon it, go beyond it. And how does one go beyond it? By completely surmounting the base of infinite space, aware there is nothing. That means one focuses on the infinite space, or one attends to the base of infinite consciousness, but focusing on the absence of any kind of obstruction or any kind of solidity or substantiality within that infinite consciousness. And that is the aspect of nothingness in that infinite consciousness. So in this way, one enters and dwells in the base of nothingness. That is what is beyond it. But the Buddha says, even this is not enough. Abandon it, I say. And what lies beyond the base of nothingness? There is still a fourth formless meditation, which is called the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And so one enters this base of neither perception nor non-perception, and the Buddha says, even this is not enough. Abandon it, go beyond it. And what is beyond the base of neither perception nor non-perception? Here the Buddha says, one enters and dwells in the cessation of perception and feeling. Okay, this is a meditative attainment in which all perception and all feeling come to an end. Okay, and so then the Buddha concludes and he says, thus I speak of the abandoning even of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And then he asks, do you see, Udayi, any fetter, small or great, of whose abandoning I do not speak? And then Udayi says, no, venerable sir. And that is the end of the discourse. Okay. Maybe this seems very abstract and very remote. If it does, don't worry about it. But these are we should just remember that these are the higher stages of meditation, which correspond to these deep layers of the mind. And even if we're still at an elementary stage in our meditation practice, we should remember that we're moving in the direction of these attainments, and we shouldn't become attached to any of them, have to give up the attachment to all of them in order to gain the final liberation. Okay, maybe then if there are any questions, then please feel welcome to ask. Okay, we'll take first, Steve, is that your name? Yeah.
Paul. But the Buddha's own experience, he first attained the eight jhanas, right? Before he went and practiced asceticism, is that correct? Is that the sequence of his practice? He attained the eight jhanas.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Right, yeah.
So while he was practicing asceticism, presumably he was still able to, his mind was still able to access the eight jhanas.
Yeah, but it seems that during the period when he was practicing asceticism, he didn't go into the jhanas, into these formless meditative attainments. Yeah, because the way it's shown in the suttas, especially this is sutta number 26, he learned the seventh and eighth formless meditations, or actually the third and fourth formless meditations, under his early meditation teachers. And when he reached those attainments, each of them, he realized this attainment doesn't lead to dispassion, to enlightenment, to nibbana. And so he gave up on them, and then he took up the practice of asceticism, extreme asceticism, perhaps believing that this is the way to liberation. But what's interesting, especially when we consider this sutta here, when the Buddha then gave up the ascetic practices and then discovered what was to be the real path to enlightenment, what he discovered was the use of the jhanas as the means to enlightenment. And then, the way we see it in the text, the Buddha only enters the four jhanas. He masters the four jhanas. He doesn't go back into the formless attainments, but he masters the fourth jhana, and then on the basis of the fourth jhana, he gains the three higher knowledges, culminating in the knowledge of the destruction of the defilements. So this sutta, it seems to be saying that to gain liberation, you have to go through the eight stages of attainment. But the way we actually understand it from many other suttas, the formless meditations are not really necessary. So just based on the jhanas, one could go all the ways to final liberation without going into the four formless attainments.
So
okay, you ask whether they have relatively little value. It raises the interesting question, if that's the case, why does the Buddha include them in some of the presentations of his teaching? This is my own supposition. During the Buddha's time, these stages of meditation were known to the yogis. And so there would have been yogis outside the Buddha's teaching who were practicing these meditations. And so when they would come, sometimes they would be attracted to the Buddha's Dharma. And so they would give up their old system, their old form of practice, and come to the Buddha's teaching. And so the Buddha realized that he could include these meditations within the framework of his teaching and use them as a way to guide those meditators who are coming from another type of background, who are coming from meditative paths that emphasize the formless meditations. And so the Buddha would teach them how to use the formless meditations as a foundation for developing insight. And so in this way, in order to bring all of the stages of samadhi into the structure of his teaching, the Buddha included the four jhanas, the four formless meditations, and then the state called the cessation of perception and feeling. And it seems also the stage called the cessation of perception and feeling was not known outside the Buddha's teaching. This seems to be quite unique to the Buddha's teaching. But in order to reach that state, the cessation of perception and feeling, one has to master all eight stages, all eight previous stages of meditation, and then develop insight on the basis of each of those stages. And so it's not, to gain liberation, it's not necessary to reach the cessation of perception and feeling. But the Buddha himself had reached that stage, and he had disciples who were able to reach that stage. And so he probably included the formless meditations because that was part of the process to be used for gaining this final stage of absorption, the cessation of perception and feeling. Okay, Dylan, you had a question as well.
I did, but it was exactly the same as Paul's question.
Exactly the same.
Collected consciousness.
that you could recommend for someone starting out?
Yeah, there are books that I would recommend. You don't have to worry about these stages. But what I would recommend, the good book is called Mindfulness in Plain English by Venerable Hainapola Gunaratana. It's available from Wisdom Publications. Joseph Goldstein, some of his books are quite good. Do we have on our website, I remember we were going to have a list of books, Marcy? It's on there. And does it have a category of books on meditation? Yeah, but anyway, if you look on Wisdom Publications, on their website, you'll see a number of books on meditation. Another good one is called, I think, Focused and Fearless, or Fearless and Focused, by Shaila Catherine. It's also from Wisdom Publications. Do we have some of the little booklets in the front on basic meditation instruction? Excuse me? There was one by Ajahn Brahmavangso on mindfulness of breathing. I remember we used to have it for free distribution. But I don't know if I... Anyway, you can look in the front. There could be some useful books on meditation practice there for free, yeah. Okay, any further questions? Okay, if there's no further questions, then we will stop for the evening. And the next class will be in September. Did somebody make note of the date? It's on the website. No, it's already on the website. Yeah. Or I told Jane already. Okay. Can you get the website here? Not posted yet. Anyway, Marianne, you're sending the announcements out now, is that it?
Yes.
Yeah, if anybody is not yet registered for the class, then just give your email address to Marianne. You put your hand up so they see who you are. Then she will send the announcement out about the next class. It will be a Tuesday and a Monday in September. I fixed the dates, I know that, and I sent it to Jane. But I don't remember what the dates are. Excuse me? Okay. Okay, so then we'll end the class now with sharing of the merits. And next time, the next sutta will be Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 67, the Chattuma Sutta. And I have to forewarn you, the women, there's a statement here which I don't empathize with it, but this is part of the monastic culture of early Buddhism. It's a little bit of a strong statement, but... Don't get discouraged and go on strike against my class. Okay, we end with sharing of the merits. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.